Christopher Rice, what do you think most of the men who serve in the U.S. Marine share in common?
Really, what struck me was they're united by a code, right? Which is, you know, if you put aside all politics, if you put aside the specifics of every sort of military engagement they've been involved in over the past decades, they're about fighting for the man standing next to them. You know, and it's a code that insulates them from the shifts in the political climate. It insulates them from the rhetoric that defines the current political scene. They go where they're told to go, and their job is to defend the Marine standing next to them. And when I heard that said clearly enough times, I thought, well, a story about a straight Marine coming to accept not only his gay Marine friend, but the boyfriend of that guy, mm-hmm. is not as far-fetched as it may seem on the surface. Because what bonds these men together is incredibly strong, and I have nothing but respect for it. And it often doesn't get play in the press. You know, I think there's a stereotype out there of the Marine as a sort of, you know, radical right-wing, didactic kind of guy. And believe me, there are plenty of Marines who will further that stereotype. But there are plenty of them that are very apolitical, that are incredibly well-read, but that they see themselves as men apart. They see themselves as not members of the mainstream, that they're different. And in that sense, they have things in common with gay men. I mean, it sounds crazy, but, you know, Marines are sort of taught in boot camp that mainstream society is weak and defective, and they provide a very special service to it. They protect it and defend it. And that's a similar line of thinking to a lot of what gay men think. We think mainstream society is hostile and colorless, and we provide sort of beauty and style and culture to it.
The Feast of Fools is brought to you by fantastic, insightful, almost telekinetically gorgeous people just like you.
Without your support, we really couldn't do this show, so please visit feastoffools.net, make a donation, buy a t-shirt today.
Your financial contributions mean the world to us.
Thank you for your support.
Hell is at my door. How nice of them to warn me a whole lifetime before. I've got the rest of my life till Judgment Day is due. Oops, look at the time, I bet you got better things to do. I was not raised the way you were, and yes, I'm glad I was born this way. Get out of my face, deal with it like I am.
It's the podcast that satiates your hunger for large, massive amounts of truth. Truth! You thought I was going to say something dirty, didn't you? It's the Feast of Fools. On today's show, we're talking to author Christopher Rice. His brand new best-selling book, Blind Fall, is a dramatic thriller about a battle-scarred Marine who discovers that his brutally murdered friend was gay. The Marine then teams up with his friend's surviving lover to seek justice.
Listen as we talk to Christopher about interviewing tough Marines for the book.
Coming out to his famous mother, the novelist Anne Rice.
Where have all the divas gone?
And negative press. How Christopher handles those bitchy bloggers when he Googles his own name. I'm Fausto Furnos.
I'm Mark Villian.
And this is the song Protest Song from Eric Hyman's brand new album Resonate, available through our website, feastoffools.net.
Stay tuned.
They say family values are under attack, and I agree. Every time I see a gay kid kicked out on his back, how can parents be so cruel? Throw you out with no remorse. If that was me, I'd say. If that was me, I'd say. I was not raised the way you were, and yes, I'm glad way. Sorry, I'm gay, deal with it like I am. Deal with it like I am.
Hello.
Hi, Christopher Rice. It's Fausto Furnos.
And Mark Fillion from the Feast of Fools podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Christopher, we wanted to know, what was your research process like for creating your new book, Blind Fall?
Well, it was intense because I knew that if I was going to, I knew I was going to have to do the book entirely from the point of view of a straight Marine if it was going to work. So So, like,
so you watch a lot of porn to research
this? No, they're not straight. I needed a real straight. I needed not even a sexually fluid Marine, not a bisexual Marine. John Houck is as straight as they come. So Dirk Yates wasn't going to cut it on this one. not that there's anything wrong with that. But anyway, right. I had to get out and I had to meet both gay and straight Marines and engage them in conversation. I mean, that was really, that's the only way you're going to get to see the unique perspective these guys have on the world. I mean, I read a lot of books, a lot of books. I gobbled up anything I could about Marine Corps culture, but you know, you got to get out there and get.
How did you meet them? Were you going out to bases and just talking to them, or you were hanging out in bars and where they would hang out at?
I've always known gay Marines ever since I moved to California. I think one of the side effects of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is that they stopped doing undercover sweeps of gay bars. So, gay Marines, gay Army men, gay Coast Guard guys, I mean, they all felt a lot more comfortable going out in gay clubs than they did before that policy went into effect. It's a shitty policy. Oh, pardon my language.
It's all right. You can say it.
But it's not, you know, I'm not defending the policy, but that is one sort of weird side effect of it, is that the bars were kind of a safe zone all of a sudden. So I've known them all my life. They've been part of my life for the past 8 years. I have readers who are in the military who write me emails about my work, you know, so.
It's usually the fans, isn't it? The first people to reveal all this information to you. And because of your high profile status, people feel very comfortable in revealing this to you.
Yeah, they do. I mean, I get amazingly candid emails from people about their experiences. I think particularly in regards to my first book, A Density of Souls, because that really resonated on a deep level with a lot of people about their high school experience. So they felt, they poured out their hearts to me, and it was, you know, it's beautiful. And sometimes it's very upsetting. The things they have to share are very disturbing.
And for those people who may not be familiar with Density of Souls, it's about a quasi-autobiographical story. There's a lot of the discussion on whether this mimics or reflects events that actually happened in your own life.
Well, it's emotionally inspired. That's the term that I like to use. I'm Stephen Conlon, the gay character in Density of Souls, certainly goes through the sense of, isolation and pain that I experienced in high school. But A Density of Souls is a thriller above all else, and it's a novel that takes place in a heightened state of reality. So it's pretty over the top, and it's meant to be that way. It's meant to be theatrical and even melodramatic. So I would stop short of saying it's a Romana Clay.
You know? And so you never actually slept with the high school football team?
No, of course not.
But you wanted to.
I wrote the book. I wanted to, you know.
And so was it hard sort of dealing with these attractive Marines and meeting face-to-face with them? I mean, you know, here they are opening up their hearts and souls to you, and I'm sure it was a very intimate experience just talking to a lot of people.
It was. It was hard because they often did not have the same emotional reaction to the stories they were telling that I was having. And so I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to overreact and shut them down. But when you have a Marine who's describing his first kill, you know, and he was barely 1 year above drinking age when he made it, and when he's describing...
When he actually murdered somebody in combat?
Well, not murdered. It's not called murder, Fausto. It's killing someone.
Well, or killing somebody. When he killed somebody in combat?
Yeah, exactly. I had to sit there and kind of, you know, empty my face of all reactions. I mean, I didn't want to appear unsympathetic, but he wasn't looking for sympathy, you know. So when you listen to those kinds of stories, it's about staying neutral. You know, it's about developing the skills that most journalists have. You know, I'm not a journalist by trade. That's not how I got my start. There are a lot of mystery writers who were, and so they sort of, they take to research in that way, but I'm a sensitive writer guy. Some stories can be.
And sometimes when they tell you these stories, it's hard to. What you're saying is it's hard for you to hide that emotion of that shock of hearing about somebody killing somebody.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do all the Marines share in common?
Really, what struck me was they're united by a code, right? Which is, you know, if you put aside all politics, if you put aside the specifics of every sort of military engagement they've been involved in over the past decades, they're about fighting for the man standing next to them. You know, and it's a code that insulates them from the shifts in the political climate. It insulates them from the rhetoric that defines the current political scene. They go where they're told to go, and their job is to defend the Marine standing next to them. And when I heard that said clearly enough times, I thought, well, a story about a straight Marine coming to accept not only his gay Marine friend, but the boyfriend of that guy,
mm-hmm.
is not as far-fetched as it may seem on the surface. Because what bonds these men together is incredibly strong, and I have nothing but respect for it. And it often doesn't get play in the press. You know, I think there's a stereotype out there of the Marine as a sort of, you know, radical right-wing, you know, didactic, you know, kind of guy. And believe me, there are plenty of Marines who will further that stereotype. But there are plenty of them that are very apolitical, that are incredibly well-read, but that they see themselves as men apart. They see themselves as not members of the mainstream, that they're different. And in that sense, they have things in common with gay men. I mean, it sounds crazy, but, mm-hmm. you know, Marines are sort of taught in boot camp that mainstream society is weak and defective, and they provide a very special service to it. They protect it and defend it. And that's a similar line of thinking to a lot of what gay men think. We think mainstream society is hostile and colorless, and we provide sort of beauty and style and culture to it.
Do you see yourself that way?
I don't know. I'm kind of middle brow. You know, I'm about, you know, I think if I have an agenda, which I don't want to say I do, but something that seems to be the trend in all my work is about kind of tackling stories that could be called mainstream and drawing gay characters into them. You know, so I think there are writers out there, there are gay writers out there that are doing things that are far edgier and far more experimental than what I'm doing. I'm out to kind of, I mean, I'm a fan of mysteries and thrillers. You know, mm-hmm. I can read mysteries and thrillers in the middle of a hurricane and not be disturbed.
During Katrina or?
No.
Okay.
No, during Katrina I wept and watched television and tried not to smoke because
sure.
I had just quit smoking. But, no, and so really that's where my heart lies, is in stories that a lot of literary types would consider conventional.
So why did you go to, because your mother's Anne Rice is a famous novelist and she goes into the supernatural realm. Did you intentionally not do the supernatural route and concentrate on the thrillers?
Well, if it was intentional, I wasn't conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't where my interests were. It just wasn't. I experimented with a lot of different kinds of stories before I wrote something that I would even consider showing to other people, and the supernatural was never a part of any of it, you know? So I don't think there were supernatural ideas that I stepped on or shoved aside because of that fear.
Christopher, the story of Barry Winchell that you may or may not be familiar with that catapulted Calpurnia Adams
mm-hmm.
into the public spotlight, where he was murdered by his fellow soldiers when it was revealed that he was having a love affair with a transgendered woman.
Mm-hmm.
Did stories like that make their way or inform you in this book, Blind Fall?
You know, I think, I may be mistaken, but I don't believe I had heard of that story when I first got the idea for Blind Fall 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that was before the murder of Barry Winchell, which I heard about later and is a story that I'm familiar with. And really, I even got this idea before the murder of Matthew Shepard. Now, it was only a few weeks before, which kind of flipped me out. But, I mean, the idea came to me is, what if a gay couple was horribly gay-bashed, and one of them turned out to have been a Marine, and that guy died? And the one who lived was the boyfriend who was kept secret from all his Marine friends. So, at the time, I thought the gay-bashing element of it was over the top. At the time, the only gay-bashing that I had I mean, really sort of vicious gay bashing. It had landed a friend of mine in New Orleans in the hospital with his jaw wired shut for weeks, and I had been out of town when it had happened, and I had been, you know, traumatized by hearing the details about it. But until Matthew Shepard, that was the only real act of heinous anti-gay violence that had touched my life. And so it was the only act of violence that really inspired the idea for this novel.
Christopher, how did the Marines you interviewed, how have they reacted to this book?
One of them hasn't been able to read it yet because he's still over there, and it would be too weird for him to get a copy of it, given the situation he's in. You know, another gay Marine who's given it his endorsement is Rich Merritt, who I've gotten to know as a result of basically publishing the book. I knew of Rich Merritt. He wrote his memoir, was called Secrets of a Gay Marine Porn Star, And he read the book as soon as it came out and contacted me and gave it his endorsement and his blessing. Other than that, you know, I'm waiting to see. You know, because with a book like this, I know I will have gotten certain things wrong that bother them.
Because this book just came out, right?
They're like, it's supposed to be F-42 rifle, not a 639 or something like that.
Thing. It's like they can get really hung up on the details, so...
Well, it's sort of like, you know, like science fiction geeks. They really want to get the specific details about things. And in a lot of ways, like being in the military, it's sort of like being in outer space or, you know.
Another planet.
Right. Another planet, you know, it is. Because whenever I talk to military guys, they're all huge science fiction fans. And we actually have one listener who serves on the Enterprise, the real Enterprise, which is a naval ship.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to... And so for a lot of them, they see a close affinity to science fiction and television programs like Star Trek. I guess I'm trying to understand, it's like when you're always writing fiction, there is some sort of level of fantasy there that you can take these characters in a direction that they normally wouldn't go in.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Although what was important to me about this book was to take John Houck out of that environment that he had been so comfortable in, that sort of highly specified...
The military environment?
Yeah. I mean, the book picks up with John after he's left the Marine Corps because he feels he's really royally screwed up in a combat situation and he just can't go back. And he isn't kicked out, but he chooses not to re-up. So, you know, we're meeting him when he's kind of cut adrift, and that sort of science fiction-like world that you talked about where he's sort of he's been hiding out from his problems for years and has been successful within, is gone now. He's not in it anymore, and he's not protected by it anymore. So there's that environment. I think really, if there's one thing my mom and I have in common, it's our use of setting. You know, we both get incredibly invested in the atmosphere and the ambience and the stuff, for lack of a better word.
The windmills of your mind.
Yeah.
Why did you set this in Southern California in those wonderful, that windmill valley close to Palm Springs?
Yes, Banning Pass. I love the desert. I remember when I was first moving to L.A. years ago, and I had been driving for days, and I hit those windmills against the backdrop of those unbelievably dramatic mountains, which, I mean, coming from Louisiana... The highest mountain in Louisiana is about 8 feet tall.
Well, it's like a setting for a James Bond movie or something, you know?
Well, it's kind of creepy and eerie, the windmill place.
Because it's quiet.
But it's creepy, it's eerie, but it's beautiful. I think the monotony, when things are monotonous like that, there's a certain creepy level to it.
There's a starkness. Now, the joke about those windmills is that they're only there to cool off all the meth labs in Riverside County. I don't think that's true. I think they're actually providing some energy.
I think they are.
But isn't that like a metaphor in your book that these giant, powerful machines are quiet? And a lot of it is the gay experience that all these Marines suffer through. Suffer through the discrimination is a silent suffering.
Gosh, I hadn't thought about it that way before. I think.
Well, see, I went to art school, so I can analyze this. I'll tell you what your book is about. But you tell me. I mean, what is that setting so important for you as a writer, and have this book take place in that location?
Well, I think California is a place of new beginnings in all the best ways and in all the worst ways. And there are people who call the desert, which begins in that spot, the sort of great southwestern desert in this country, either, depending on your point of view, it begins or ends at the edge of Southern California. You know, people call it the junkyard of American dreams. I mean, for some people, in the instance of the book, for the case of John's older sister, it's as far into California as she was able to get when she has to sort of take over being the parent after their parents are killed. So it's the edge of the promised land. I think that's what's so appealing about it. And also, as I say on the acknowledgments page of the book, a nonfiction book that inspired me in the writing of this was a true crime account called 29 Palms, A Tale of Murder, Marines, and the Mojave.
Ooh.
By a writer named Deanne Stillman. And while that was, you know, based on a real case and doesn't really bear a lot of resemblance to the events depicted in my book, its themes and its sort of perspective on that environment and that landscape out there, the desert around 29 Palms and Yucca Valley, were very inspirational to me in creating the life of John and his sister.
Mm. It certainly is a desperate landscape for that kind of stuff. I mean, kudos to the people that can actually survive out there.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And, you know, my mother's out there now, but she's not out in 29 Palms. she's in a different part of the desert. And
so for your stalkers, what is your exact home address?
I'm going to leave that out, I think.
But you live in West Hollywood, right?
Probably posted online somewhere.
I'm so proud of it. Do you get into a certain situation now? I mean, your mother has this enormous cachet, obviously. But, you know, you're her son, so you're like, Mom, you don't know anything.
I mean, I try not to sound quite like that. Yeah.
But, I mean, do you guys argue about where, because she's obviously want to give you advice on your books.
Oh, we don't argue. We have a good system set up with the book. We argue about plenty, but we don't argue about my books because she doesn't read them until they're done. And that gets her off the hook because then she doesn't feel like she has to edit them. And I don't have to argue with her about them.
So you show it to an editor before you even show it to your mom?
Yeah, I show it to an editor. I have my best friend who's also a writer, Eric Shaw Quinn. He reads over them pretty early on. Eric is more widely known as Pamela Anderson because he wrote her novel Star.
love that.
Yeah, he's great.
That's hot.
Do you get approached by celebrities? Are they wanting you to write their memoirs or something like that?
No, I get approached by like the woman at Walgreens who thinks I should write her memoir. And I'm like, lady, I'm sure you've had an interesting life, but I'm not hurting for ideas. You'll be amazed. There was this waitress once in L.A. who's like, you should write my story. I've been trying to be an actress for 15 years. I'm like, oh, that's your story. I thought that was everyone's.
You know, I was disappointed. Anytime that I go to Los Angeles, I never run into those kind of people.
I never see celebrities either, though. Too.
No celebrities, and nobody who's trying to be an actor for 30 years and never been able to break into. It's always like people like to drink. Maybe it's because I hang out in bars. But
that's probably it.
That might be it. Mm-hmm. I think the happiest people in L.A. have nothing to do with the entertainment industry.
That's probably true. Now, so you set your first book in New Orleans.
I did.
Or New Orleans?
No, you said it right the first time.
New Orleans.
New Orleans.
No.
And then
no.
Palm Springs is the sort of the setting of this book. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, those two cities have a lot of ghosts.
A lot of ghosts? Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Don't you think so?
Well, it's funny to think of Palm Springs in that way because the oldest building in Palm Springs is probably 25 years old.
Yeah, but the people.
It's the people, though. It's like it's something about the desert sort of dries everything up.
Well,
you know?
It's also a retirement community. I mean, that's what people forget about Palm Springs. They go there and it's like, it's really sleepy and quiet here. I'm like, yeah, it's a retirement community. Mm-hmm. It's where people go to retire.
They have one party once a year and that's it, right?
Well, they have plenty of the charity calendar, uh-huh. The charity function calendar in Palm Springs is so busy, you know, it's like good luck scheduling your function. But it's a lot of, you know, roll up, drink some wine, chat, leave, roll up at another one. You know, that's sort of the social scene in Palm Springs. I love Palm Springs, don't get me wrong. But it is what it is. But I don't feel chased by ghosts in either city. I think ghosts are probably the reason I left New Orleans, you know.
Really? Do you actually personally believe that there are ghosts walking, like spirits of the dead, walking around the city of New Orleans?
You know, I cannot say that with any certainty. I have never seen a ghost. I've had one experience with a Ouija board that totally freaked me out.
Oh, wasn't it one of your friends was moving it around and you're like, oh my God, he knows everything about me.
No, I'll tell you
what happened.
We had two friends who were on the Ouija board. And I went into another, we were testing whatever it was we were communicating with. And I went into the other room, and I pulled a book off the shelf with a very simple title, because that was the idea.
Okay.
And I hid it under my shirt, and I walked back into the room, and it spelled out the title of the book.
Ooh. So it was science behind it. Used the scientific method. Well, you did an experiment.
It was
an empirical
test.
It was an empirical
test. I thought there's a scientific explanation. You were wearing a wet see-through shirt.
And your friend saw the title.
Right.
Well, were you alone or with it? Because you never should do Ouija by yourself.
No, there were about four of us.
And so did anybody, you know, it was the thing they only had four books in those shelves or was it lucky?
No, this was, we went into a library. I mean, it was a huge library.
Really?
Hundreds of titles. Yeah.
So did you ask for the winning lottery numbers from the ghost if he got the book, right?
Well, see, no, because we didn't have the winning lottery ticket in the room. See, that would have been, the idea was it was able to see us.
but not the future.
Yeah, well, we didn't know. We didn't test it.
Well, why'd you leave New Orleans? So you left New Orleans to go to L.A. to become a screenwriter or actor? Was that your impetus of leaving that city?
Vaguely, yeah. I mean, that's sort of why I went. What really happened was I visited L.A. and fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I loved the city enough that if screenwriting never materialized, that I would be happy there.
Well, it's a fabulous place.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, and I think it gets a really bad rap from a lot of people who don't know anything about it or don't get it. You know?
But do you like the kooks?
Yeah, I do like the kooks. I like the fact that it's still the frontier. You know, it's the frontier, and you can just go, and you don't really even have to have a real name. You can have a made-up name. And
Christopher, you know, Starr.
Right.
Or something like that.
Christopher Gossamer.
Oh, really? Do you actually use fake names when you're in bars?
No.
Because I was reading about, we're a little bit younger, but when you would go to parties because of the fame of your mother, that everybody knew something about you, and that was a little bit difficult to reconcile.
I guess. Yeah. What was difficult were the lies. I mean, like, people...
Lies?
No, the lies. Like, mm-hmm. people would make up that I was followed by security guards at 40 feet at all times. I was like, what? You know, this was a New Orleans... You know, mm-hmm. New Orleans stories get very tall. You know, I thought, oh, well, that's why Mr. Wright hasn't come up yet. Mm-hmm. He's just too afraid of my security detail that doesn't actually exist.
Mm. Well, what, can't you be like Whitney Houston and fall in love with one of the security guards?
He didn't have any.
I didn't have any. Yeah.
Well, that's why he doesn't have a boyfriend.
Well, I don't know if he does now.
Yeah, better security? Is that what you're suggesting?
Maybe so. You got to get something sexy. So you came out to your mom and your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And your mom's reaction initially was that she thought it was a fad. But here's a woman who's built a career writing about sexually ambiguous characters.
Yeah.
Did you feel like a little bit like, hey, mom, cut me some slack?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, she was all about sexual ambiguity. I think it was the hard and fast statement that I was exclusively homosexual that caught her off guard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think that it was, you know, her suggestion to me was that I read Cry to Heaven.
One of her books.
About the castrati, because
yes.
That's about sexual fluidity. You know, and I, you know, there's some stock in that. You know, I think.
But how did you like being compared to a homosexual being to somebody having their nuts chopped off?
I had a problem with it, and we've since talked about it extensively. But you know what? In her defense was, you know, it's about, or that novel is not just about losing your nuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's about.
Although that was the selling point for me and why I read it. I'm like, I got to read this about somebody getting their balls chopped
off.
Absolutely.
You know, the novel is about a higher love, right? It's about a romantic love that transcends mere sexuality. At least that was my impression of what she was saying. So it was like, read that and be sure, you know, be sure of this before you go forth. But really, in the scheme of things, mm-hmm. I mean, I know the story was tantalizing to a lot of people. Oh, Anne Rice doesn't accept her gay son, but that's mm-hmm. not really whatever happened. You know,
mm-hmm.
we had.
Oh, so that because she didn't go to do a press conference and say, I love my gay son,
right.
And he's not a vampire.
Right.
You know, because she didn't do that, then otherwise she rejected you, and, you know, there's horror and.
Yeah, exactly.
Sadness.
You know, and so.
Who are
whatever.
These people who are writing these things?
It's like, people have too much time.
Well, it's the fans, you know? It's like, I mean, do you feel like in a sense that for you, now you've had three books on the New York Times bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
Four now. This one made the expanded list last week.
Yay! Congrats. Let me give you a little tambourine shake there. But so do you feel like you no longer have to sort of be compare? I mean, obviously, like in this interview, we're going to be asking you a ton of stuff about you and your mom, but... And your dad, too, but do you feel that as a writer you don't longer have to prove yourself or, you know, about nepotism or that you're living in your mom's shadow or any of that?
You know, I just have never had any control over any of that. You know, I mean, it's one of those things that I kind of let go of. You know, when I made the decision not to publish under a pen name, it was like all bets were off. It's entirely in the eyes of the beholder. You know, it's an aspect of my image that can't be managed or controlled. I just held out faith that if the books appealed strongly enough to a certain audience, that they would stand on their own. And I think that has happened, combined with, I don't know, the fact that I'm an advocate columnist, the fact that I have this sort of persona in the gay community as being maybe a little bit more than just a writer, but also kind of a spokesperson and somebody with a lot of opinions. And so I think that has allowed me to stand on my own two feet. But I will say that I think one of the perks, one of the many perks of being her last name, is that it allowed me to get some mainstream marketing for some pretty gay books, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like the term gay writer. You know, I think we should move from analyzing someone's work. We should analyze each work as it comes out of the writer, right? You know, and I think it's possible for writers who are gay to write books that are not exclusively about the gay experience.
Well, Chris, do you get any pressure from the mainstream publishing world to tone down your gay themes in the novels?
You know, I haven't really, because, I mean, I am inclined to write stuff that I think has a heightened level of sexuality in terms of atmosphere, but I don't really go in for really explicit sex scenes. I mean, I think the most explicit sex scenes I've written are in A Density of Souls, and they really do serve the plot. You know, they're descriptions of sort of bumbling, painful adolescent sexuality. If it doesn't serve the plot, I leave it out usually.
Mm-hmm. So the lead character never has sort of a sexy twist with the deceased gay lover at all, or
in Blind Fall?
I mean, I'm asking you to reveal them, because every gay man that's reading Blind Fall is going to be sort of thinking that in their mind.
I'm about three quarters of the way through, and I'm thinking, I don't think they're going to sleep together, but
no, they're not. And okay. I've been kind of
you're such a tease.
Yeah, no, they're not. They're absolutely not, because it cheapens the whole thing. Because then John's journey becomes so much shorter and more. I mean, he really has to learn to accept this guy. And if the only reason he's not accepting him is because he's secretly gay, oh God, how many times have we heard that story? It's like, you know, it just wasn't what I wanted to do with this book. I wanted to make it more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done that book. You know, I'm saying that John is my first straight character because he's the only straight guy in any of my books who doesn't end up sleeping with a character who looks exactly like me halfway through. So that makes him a man apart.
Tall, blonde, attractive.
Mm-hmm. Well, it used to be more, you know, willowy.
Willowy. Well, you look good, though. I saw that video on YouTube that's circulating with you and the windmills in the background.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What was it when the video guy was telling you, oh, let's go shoot behind the windmills, and you're like, all right.
No, that was my suggestion.
It was your suggestion?
Yeah. Because with those kinds of things, it's either that or they want you nuzzling your cat and sipping tea in your office, and it's like, yeah, this isn't that kind of book. The cat book.
Now, let's talk about when your mother went into a coma and you rushed to go to her side, and that must have been an extremely traumatic and challenging point in your life for you, wasn't it?
It was pretty challenging. I mean, it came out of nowhere. I mean, for something that serious that could have been detected and wasn't.
Because your mother was diabetic and she didn't realize it.
Right, and she was being tested for a host of other things, and they never thought to give her a basic blood sugar test, which was like, hello. It's one of those things that still baffles me. But it was very traumatic, and I think, I mean, it's the reason I wrote A Density of Souls. I mean, I hate to put it that
simply. It led you to become a writer?
Well, I was writing, but I was writing really crappy screenplays about myself, and I was living out in L.A. the first time, because I moved out there once before, and I was called home to be with her, and I was clear I was going to be there for a long time, and she was sort of getting better, and I had more free time on my hands as she was recovering, so I wanted to work on something, and all I had really at hand, because I had left L.A. so quickly, was this short story that I had written, and it turned into A Density of Souls. And it was not my plan. It was not my plan to write or publish a novel at all. Mm.
So in a way, do you think that Density of Souls was a way of trying to reconcile with your mother, or did you feel like her mortality to be so tangible?
I think that maybe was part of it. I think really it was more about reconciling with New Orleans, that I was brought back home very suddenly for an extended period of time, and there were all these memories there.
Mm-hmm. Because you lived in a pretty rough part of New Orleans, too, didn't you?
Well, we lived in the Garden District. Mm-hmm. It wasn't... The irony of New Orleans, even today, is that its wealthiest neighborhoods are literally right next door to its worst neighborhood.
Right.
And so you know, I would go to sleep at night in this big Garden District mansion listening to gunfire from the St. Thomas housing projects several blocks away. And on one occasion, we had a stray bullet come through our window. New Orleans was a dangerous place. You know, I mean, it's one of the most, it was one of the most crime-ridden cities when I lived there, and it was a very challenging aspect of it.
Now, so when your mother sort of converted to becoming a Catholic, I always thought that she might have been a Catholic, but I guess it made a lot of press. And you, as her gay son, what went through your mind, or were you aware of this? Or
I was aware of it, and I have to say there were a bunch of reasons why it didn't bother me. My experience of Catholics in New Orleans was that they were the most fun out of any religious people I'd ever met. They drank the most. They were the most. They enjoyed Mardi Gras the most. They had a sense of theater and a sense of pathos. And, you know, I wasn't that alarmed. I mean, most of my close friends were Catholic in New Orleans or had Catholic backgrounds. And it was just, they were a lot more lax and progressive than anyone gave them credit for. You know, I think there's something about Catholics where it's sort of a career. It's or part of being a Catholic to sort of not listen to the Vatican or have a sort of, oh, great, it's the Vatican again attitude, you know?
But can you be Catholic and write about vampires, or are those things, like, separated? Because I guess I'm trying to understand how, you know, what your mother's religious beliefs were before she became a Catholic. Was she goth or non-denominational?
She was a seeker, I think. I mean, that's a question for her, really. But I think that lately her answer has been that she doesn't feel she can write about vampires while practicing her Catholicism. But that's not really, I mean, that's a result of a different decision, which is that she wants to write entirely about Jesus Christ. So it's not, I don't think it's about saying no to vampires as much as it's about a shift in her focus.
But because, you know, like if Anne Rice was my mother, I'd turn around and be like, you know, why don't you make a book where Jesus was a vampire?
Well, she came real close with Memnock the Devil. I mean, there are passages in Memnock the Devil where, I mean, Lestat literally drinks the blood of Christ. I mean, that book was as frank and relentless a conversation about Catholic belief as any that, you know, I know of. And her feeling about that book was that it didn't get a lot of the attention that she was hoping it would. And one of the things she said to me recently is that for a while with the vampire books, when she went out to promote them, she would try to talk to interviewers about spirituality and about religion in connection with these stories, and they really wouldn't let her. And they didn't allow her to have that conversation until she began writing about the life of Christ explicitly. And she called me from the road when she was touring for Christ the Lord and said, they're finally letting me talk about what I want to talk about.
Because I was reading some quotes from her that were really good. I wish I had them in front of me about that a lot of her work has been, like even with the vampire books, has been about redemption and salvation, which is, you know, the story of Christ.
So the themes have stayed the same.
The themes have stayed the same in some ways.
I agree. I see. There was never. There was a quote in the USA Today piece that was done on both of us, and I can't remember who they were quoting, unfortunately. But yeah, I think it was a critic, or it was maybe the Faith and Values editor at Publishers Weekly, who said the vampire novels never celebrated villainy. You know, they were about wrestling with the belief that you were apart from God or apart from humanity. They were about the pain of that condition. You know, they weren't about the belief that the vampire was the superior being. You know, the vampires all wrestled with questions of good and evil, of how they could, if they had to kill to live, how could they go about doing that in a way that was humane and moral?
Well, and that's a theme we all struggle with, if you're a vegetarian or marine or...
Yeah, exactly.
Or even a gay man, you know, in making the choice to use a condom when you're having sex, and that brings in issues of your own mortality. Now, why do you think there are so many religious people who still hold on to the idea that being gay is wrong when so many people have been able to say it's okay?
Well, I believe the people who are holding on to the idea are holding on to it more firmly because they are starting to realize they are endangered. I think it is actually the progress that we're making in this country that is inflaming the homophobes, and so they're speaking out louder and more aggressively. And
so the homophobes are the ones who are on fire.
Yeah, and they're setting themselves on fire because they need to get their point across. I mean, I don't think that means we shouldn't take them seriously and we shouldn't engage them and we shouldn't contradict them when they spread lies and disinformation about gay people. But I think that's really the truth. I mean, I think ignorance, ignorance isn't really the right word in this context. I think dismissal or sort of being passed over or ignored is the greatest form of homophobia. I think if we're being attacked, it's because we're perceived as gaining strength and power.
Do you read all your negative press?
It depends on what you define as negative press.
Well, someone's writing really mean and hurtful things about you intentionally to bother and hurt you.
Well, I don't know if I ever presume what somebody else's intentions are. I believe what I don't do, or what I do a lot less of, is, you know, everyone Googles themselves now and then. And if you do that, it brings you into context with people will say things online that they would never dream of saying to your face, specifically if they're allowed to be in a form and be anonymous, mm-hmm. or be under a pseudonym. And that stuff is just schoolyard crap. Yeah. I mean, you just can't. I've stopped reading it.
How do you handle it? I mean, when you do read it and you're just like, it'll keep you up at late at night and you're like, damn, that's a lie. I mean, here, let me read you a little quote here. The you said in an interview with Ron Hogan that you read all your press, even negative ones, and there was some criticism on some blogs about A Density of Souls that the story of a slutty gay teenager who slept with a football team was a thinly veiled autobiography. And I'm like, how dare you? I only slept with two of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, did I call him a slutty gay teenager?
No, they called you a slutty gay teenager sleeping with a football team. And I'm like,
well, they're just jealous then. No.
I mean, you could have.
I didn't sleep with the football team.
But we all wanted to, though. It was a swim team.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, when you hear those kind of hurtful things, do you feel like, does it attack your core self, or do you feel like
no.
I mean, raise doubt in your head?
That's nothing. I mean, that's nothing compared to what you could find out there. And you can't, I mean, they don't know me, so how could they ever get access to my core?
Do you turn to the blogger and say, how many books have you had on the bestseller list? Zero.
I try. I mean, you know what I've usually found is that in those sort of blog debates, the people who rush to my defense usually outnumber the people who are saying snide, nasty things about me. And I think what I found, you know, my mother will get emails from people that would make your hair stand on end. And she'll respond to them. And they will absolutely cave in and collapse in the wake of that. Oh, I'm so sorry, Miss Rice, blah, 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 blah. Because what they want is attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to get attention.
Right.
You know? So I'm not really interested in giving them any attention, you know. What I meant when I said I read my good and bad press is I read reviews of my books, even mm-hmm. if they're negative.
Now, but I mean, you have stalkers, right?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Because a lazy stalker, Mark, tell people what a lazy stalker.
He doesn't have any stalkers.
But lazy stalkers, in case you run into
any. In case you get any stalkers, Chris, we found that because we get people that stalk us from time to time, is you try and get them to do work for you. Put them to work, because stalkers are essentially very lazy people, and they don't want to do anything. All they want to do is put their bullshit on you, and that's it.
Right.
And you say, hey, can you help me with this? You'll never see them again.
You know what you got? Because you travel with a lot of these heavy books, right?
Uh-huh.
So one of these stalkers are going to be, you're going to be in Barnes & Noble
gonna be everywhere.
Later this week?
Where are you going to be this week?
Oh, my God. I'm going everywhere. I'm in Connecticut right now.
You fly like every day for the next month.
Practically.
How do you keep up with a schedule like that?
Oh, a lot of prayer. No, you know, it's usually not too brutal. If mm-hmm. I don't have to wake up at the crack of dawn every day, I mm-hmm. have a fine time with it. But, you know, I have a really good friend who I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. Eric Sharquin. And, you know, what he says to me is, you know, if book tours are too rough, there's always work at Kinko's.
That's true.
Well, see,
I started having a little moment yesterday because my flight was delayed by several hours. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't want to, you know, and he was like, Kinko's.
Of course, all your fans that work at Kinko's now are like,
but you're going to be in Chicago at the end of the week, March 29th, and then off to St. Louis, Kansas City, Cincinnati.
Yeah, this
week,
I'm, you know, New York, Philadelphia, D.C., and Denver.
And wow. so you go to these book readings, I guess, and you
who shows up?
A lot of people show.
Are they young gay guys? Are they
wearing all black?
No.
Or military men?
No, the goth thing receded after the first book. I think there were a lot of sort of curiosity people.
Mm-hmm.
who were just looky-loos because I was Anne Rice's son. And now it's a more, it really depends on the bookstore. I mean, in Atlanta, I had 150 people. And then on the average city, I have more like 30 or 20 people, which is a real, for a book reading, that's a really nice turnout. I mean, like a lot of, if 10 people show up, it's, for any reading, it's considered a success.
Right.
They're usually gay men who span, they span the age range. They're not, you know, all younger or all older. They're a nice mix. And there are some women, too. A lot of women.
Now, this photo that you have with that David LaChapelle took of you with some glove that you're scratching the hell out of yourself.
The werewolf glove.
The werewolf glove.
Right.
How old were you in that picture? You look like a baby.
I was 21.
Oh.
Or I, maybe was... I had just turned 22. I was a baby.
You
I
were
had no
chicken.
Idea what was happening. And let me say for the record, that was not a glove. They actually made that out of individual strands of yak hair. It took 3 hours to make.
Oh, really?
And I had to sit in a chair, and they used spirit gum and sort of clumps of the hair, which they glued on clump by clump by
Why were they putting, why were they making you scratch the hell out of your chest, though?
Well, the original conception for the photo was he didn't know what I looked like, and he just assumed I was going to be like a big, unattractive geek or some sort of bookish, nerdy kid. And so he was going to put me in a suit and have me sort of tearing open the suit so that I looked kind of everyday and introverted and maybe a little nerdy. But my creative side was coming out in this sort of flash of violence. But then I showed up, and he thought I was cute. So
you're like hot
tank top. So
that's LaChapelle.
Yeah.
So what are your? You write a lot about sort of. You recently wrote about divas
And
Paris Hilton being the Grand Marshal of 2005. Gay pride parade in Los Angeles. What did you feel that was a sellout? Or what was the? Because you live in LA, so you were sort of
LA, yeah.
You saw that whole thing unfold. What was? Why did they put Paris Hilton on the front of the parade?
As the Grand Marshal.
Well, it was a crass attempt to get young people to come to the parade, and you know whatever. I think what was the most remarkable about it was the speed of the response from the gay community. I mean, like right away. The gay community said, yeah, we're not this dumb. Yeah, we're not this stupid. She's not a gay icon. She hasn't done anything for the community. We're not impressed. And that was what was the most remarkable, and that's what I sort of commented on in my column, you know, that the gay community immediately said, you've got to do better than this. You know, this is not the way to pump up this parade.
But is it because we feel more comfortable putting our hopes and aspirations on whatever we perceive to be a diva or strong, powerful woman, as opposed to putting it on ourselves?
Well, no. I think we're at a loss for... We haven't found really strong, powerful women to make our focus right now. We're sort of glamorizing these sort of trashy sluts. I mean, I don't think Paris Hilton is a strong, powerful woman. I think she's governed by her avarice and her greed and her bad attitude and her lack of gratitude for everything she's been given in her life. I think that's what defines Paris Hilton. And I think we as an audience are more content right now to sort of leer at the train wreck that she is rather than to sort of elevate someone who might actually be a real diva. I mean, I think...
Well, you're a diva, Christopher.
Oh,
I mean, seriously, like somebody should put you in the front of a gay pride parade. There's thousands in this country in every major city, and Paris Hilton's, you know, calendar's a little busy that time of year.
Yeah,
because there are a lot of coke parties happening. So you know, it's like put Christopher in the front of the parade.
You're sweet.
But the point of your article was saying is that right now that we are lacking true, real divas. Because what has happened to all? Where have all the divas gone?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, we're not alone in this. It's not just our fault. It has to do with sort of who's being presented to us by the mainstream media as sort of being, you know, the focus of their attentions right now. And I think for some reason, we are fixated on the travails of these women. And I don't know if it's because they represent some societal frustration. I think we are enjoying hating them. And I don't think that is enough to drive popular culture, a contempt for the sort of Marie Antoinettes of our age is not enough. You know, I think we as gay men can be contributing more.
Well, our guest today has been the fantastically, but not necessarily gay, novelist, Christopher Rice's brand new book, Blind Fall.
It is a book about a Marine who finds his best friend gay-bashed and dead. And, well, this guy was also his personal hero. And so he attempts to find justice along with the deceased Gay Lover.
And it's already on the bestseller list.
Yes.
Yeah, congratulations.
So you don't even need us.
And we want you to.
It's Kribner Press, and it's fantastic, and it's a great photo of you, and this guy really looks as hot as he... And as, boy, it's like, you know, you're a catch, Christopher.
Do you have a boyfriend?
No.
You
don't? Single and available, and he's touring America.
What kind of men do you like?
That's a loaded question. Well, I guess it's not really a loaded answer.
Well, who, what kind of men do you want seeking you out?
I usually go for guys who are shorter than me, and that's not hard.
How tall are you?
I'm 6'3".
Okay, well, that's not hard.
So
it's
most
fine.
Guys are shorter than me. I'm, you know, I don't know.
Intelligent, attractive,
like intelligent
wealthy.
Kind of nerdy, boyish guys. That's kind of who I go for.
With okay. Big, juicy cocks.
With luscious bottoms.
With luscious bottoms.
So we're going to do our Breakdown 2008 with you.
Hey, 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 it's the Breakdown 2008.
Yeah. So
I
these
don't
know
are. This is
20 questions.
Roll with it.
You're in the.
It's 20 questions. Just answer
hairs.
Real quick. Don't think about it.
Okay. These are the crosshairs of the gun, Christopher, into your psyche, into your soul. I'm using a lot of that soul language because you're from New Orleans.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is your favorite color?
Purple.
What's the best thing that's happened to you recently?
I got a rave review in the Los Angeles Times for Blindfall.
Wonderful. Fantastic. What is the worst thing that happened to you recently?
What's the worst thing that happened to me recently?
The airplane thing? Kinko's?
Yeah, probably the airplane thing. The worst thing that happened to me? God, why is this one freaking me out? I had to go to, my flight was delayed.
Okay.
Life is great.
You're not telling us the real thing.
Christopher, how do you like your toast?
How do I like my toast? Crispy.
How crispy.
Where do you feel most comfortable and happy?
Where do I feel most comfortable and happy? In my apartment.
What's a song you heard recently you loved?
Angel by Natasha Bedingfield.
What was the name and species of your favorite childhood pet?
Lucky, and he was a bull mastiff.
Ooh, that's a big dog.
What's your best feature?
Oh.
Keep it clean. Your hair.
Your hair?
Yeah, my hair.
Where do you want to be in 5 years from now?
If I'm on the same road, I'll be just fine.
Okay.
What is the biggest misconception people have about you?
Oh, probably that they think I'm going to be goth because of who my mother is.
Mm-hmm. What turns you on in another person?
Oh, passion.
If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
No, it wouldn't be him. if I could change one thing, I guess it would probably be my voice.
Okay. Would you want it to be higher, lower, or?
Lower and less nasal.
You sound pretty masculine to me, though.
You have to get Calpurnia Adams' video that says, "This is the voice I want to use."
This is the voice I want to use.
But I think you have a wonderful voice.
Yeah, I think
thank
too.
You.
So who made a difference in your life?
Oh, gosh. My best friend, Eric Sharquin.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Eric, what makes you mad?
What makes me mad?
Yeah.
Ignorance.
How should we get out of debt?
How should the country get out of debt?
Or anyway. Individually or collectively?
It's a metaphor.
Oh, it's a metaphor. Personal accountability.
Okay.
So what does that mean?
You're accountable for what you do.
Yeah.
So you have to pay the bills. If your vagina wrote its own monologue, what would it say?
Oh, my vagina. This is hard. You guys are good. My vagina wrote its own monologue. It would say, I don't exist because I don't have a vagina. So,
What is your greatest weakness?
Jewish boys.
Ooh.
Do you play any musical instruments?
No.
What are you doing after this taping of this show?
I'm doing a reading.
Okay. What happens to us when we die?
We are reborn.
As what?
Different people.
Oh, really? Oh, wonderful.
Well, Christopher, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad that your book is in the bestseller list.
Thank you.
It's fantastic. And, you know, Christopher will be appearing this summer in front of gay pride parades across the country.
we'll see.
If we get a chance, we're going to come out and see you in Skokie.
Oh, good.
We'll be there.
Christopher, thank you so much for your
time.
Thank
you, Christopher.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Christopher Rice lives in Los Angeles.
West Hollywood.
In West Hollywood or
yeah,
Los Angeles?
I think he lives in West Hollywood.
WeHo.
He's in gay zone.
So his book, Blind Fall, is from Scribner Press, is available through our website, feastoffools.net. It is on the best New York Times bestseller list already.
I know. Can you believe it? And it just came out.
So if you, for those of you municipalities that are organizing your gay pride parades right now, I recommend getting writers like Christopher Rice,
you know,
on the front of your parade. Yeah. Fuck Paris.
Get a real
Hilton.
Gay person that has lived up being gay
and not successful.
Like come out after their career is over. You know,
I know he's in the middle of the throes of his creativity, of his passion. He's
and
not a vampire,
and he's really tall. So when he sits in the car, everybody will see him.
And he's attractive.
And he's attractive.
And he's smart.
And he's
and
smart.
He's funny.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't say there's nothing wrong. And he's single. Everybody's like, ooh. At home, you know they're just drooling.
I
like,
know they're
I think he's America's most attractive gay bachelor.
Author, maybe.
Bachelor,
well, bachelor
I don't know. is a one that's not in a relationship
right.
with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so some people might argue that about anybody else, but... Mm-hmm. You know,
Faust, so you're smitten
never,
with him.
They're never. Well, he's fabulous.
I totally do him.
Loved
totally
him.
Do. And I'm shorter. I'm shorter than 6'3".
Are you?
Yes, I am.
I'm
not.
Totally, I thought you were 6'2".
I'm 5'11", almost 6 feet. So, is it really proper to say you do your guests after you
well,
hang
you
up with them?
Well, you just said it.
I guess.
Meanwhile, probably, your husband over here is looking at you like.
I do you too, sweetheart. Of course, and of course, I'm not going to have sex.
Do
with
I?
Chris Rice.
How many best-selling books do I need to write in order to get your attention, Mark?
Just one.
Really?
That's all. It would
My
take.
Husband, the jerk.
I'm just teasing.
Just kidding. So the Feast of Fools has been brought to you by fabulous listeners like you. Your financial contributions help make the show happen. So go to our website, feastoffools.net, and make a contribution. It pays for the bandwidth and for the website development costs.
We have a brand new website coming out to you very soon, so please check it out. Visit feastoffools.net.
Home of fabulousness. Mm-hmm. The Feast of Fools is produced by me, Fausto Fernos.
And me, Mark Fillion.
It's edited by me, Fausto Fernos. And
show notes written by Fausto and edited by Mark. Or written by Mark and edited by Fausto.
Our assistant producer, who helped book the guest on today's show, is Andrew Jocelyn. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you so much. And he came up with wonderful questions for us to ask him. And I also want to thank some of our listeners from the community forums that also came up with some great questions. I'd like to thank Johnzu, Van Man, Croc, Voce Angelo, Curtis, and Robert.
Without you, we can't make this show happen. So thank you for our community. And thanks to Christopher Rice, Blind Fall. Get it right now. You can get it a little discount if you order it through our website, feastoffools.net. It's the Foth discount.
Foth.
So it makes it hot. We love you. The show, the podcast that loves you back. Do you know that we have a free song every week on our Feast Blast? It's our mini magazine of odd news, quirky interviews, and social trends, plus cocktail recipes, because every weekend you need a cocktail.
You do.
To fix, because life is stressful enough without the Feast Blast.
It comes out on hump day to get you through the week.
Hump day, middle of the week.
Middle week, Wednesday, yeah. So you start drinking early. You can have a virtual cocktail while you're at work.
You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/feastoffools, and learn all about the behind the scenes of what makes the world's most downloaded podcast happen.
And for something a little more outrageous, subscribe to twitter.com/insults so you can get a daily insult.
That's right. Oh, the music featured on today's show is Eric Hyman with the song you're listening to now is Open the Door from his album Resonate. You can learn more about it and order it on our website, feastoffools.net. Bye.
She's crying and trying to love you. Now open the door. I'm looking through the winter window. Your new family surrounding you. I remember how we once were. I wonder if you remember that too. And I've learned to get by. Just like all birds learn to do. That nest you left a mess.
the door.